If anybody has any questions they'd like to ask in English, please either write them down or prepare them mentally. Or if you'd like to just ask me normally, then that's fine also. The first question this morning, a very common question. What is the point in chanting in Pali without fully understanding the meaning? If so, is there a deeper meaning for those on the receiving end? Prime example, funeral chanting. Well, first of all, the chanting in Pali without fully understanding the meaning, that's entirely up to you. I mean, if you want to know the meaning, the translation is there. If you want to learn what it means, then you can. if you're willing to make the effort to find out all the Pali chants, whether they're, and what we've been chanting here, we translate line by line into Thai, as you know. There are also English translations, but even the chanting that you'll hear when monks attend ceremonies, all those chants have translations easily found, and a lot of them have very profound meanings. Is there a deeper meaning for those on the receiving end, as in funeral chanting? Yes, that's somewhat more difficult to answer. I would say that when I went down to Phuket, Phanga, following the tsunami, and then a number of people said that after the monks had chanted the funeral chants and they'd offered the sangatan, that a lot of the ghosts that people had seen disappeared, didn't come back again, as if they were waiting for that chanting and merit. So obviously if someone has not gone on to the next life, if you know now that this matika chanting or funeral chanting is one part of a funeral ceremony, then you might well be waiting around for it after you die. So you might possibly be interested in it. The background to this chanting, if you don't know, is that there is a story. I must admit, it's one of the accounts that's been handed down to us, which I believe to be a legend rather than historical truth, and that is the account of the Buddha going up to teach what we call the Abhidhamma in a heaven realm to his mother. If you remember, the Buddha's mother died shortly after his birth, and he was brought up by his foster mother, who later became the first nun, the first bhikkhuni, Maya Gautami. But some time after his enlightenment, the Buddha went up to the heaven realm in which his mother was living and taught her the Abhidhamma. And the story goes that he'd be there all day, and then he'd come down in the evening and relate the teachings he'd given to his mother to Venerable Sariputta, who recorded them. I won't go into all the reasons why I don't believe that that's a historically authentic account, but it is the reason why it is considered appropriate for these Abhidhamma verses to be chanted at funerals. It's considered to be following a tradition going back to the time of the Buddha himself. Those of you who go to funerals or have been to funerals in Bangkok will probably have noticed in the last few years that there has been a response to the criticism of lengthy Abhidhamma chanting in funeral ceremonies. Some monasteries now will chant in Thai, some monasteries chant in Pali and Thai, some monasteries chant just for a very few minutes, and sometimes we'll have a Dhamma talk instead, or not instead, but as well. So I think that there is a general change in the customs regarding funerals, particularly in Bangkok. But I think the important point about funerals remains that if people go and just sit around and chat all the time, then it's disrespectful to the person who's passed away, even if the family don't object and it's considered normal. From my point of view, it's not showing any respect to the person who's died, and that the point of the ceremony is to create merit within your mind, in your heart, and then to dedicate it to the person who's passed away. So there is a fair amount of socialization, chatting at funeral ceremonies, but at least if the monks are chanting, then most people with manners anyway will stop talking. And at least that's a time in which your mind can be quiet and just reflect on the life of the person who's passed away and any kindnesses they might have done you, and generally the bun kun that they have towards you. So it's a time for quiet reflection, and you can sit and do what we've been doing here the last couple of days: watch your breath and purify your mind, and then that power of calm and mindfulness is merit. It's a power, something that can be dedicated, so that funeral ceremony can just be a kind of empty ritual. Or it can be a very meaningful ceremony. And the difference between an empty ritual and a meaningful ceremony is really the attitude of the people who are involved and people who attend. So I say yes, in terms of content, the Abhidhamma chanting at funerals is perhaps not so uplifting or inspiring. It has a historical, cultural reason for being, and in many places there have been efforts now to increase the content side with chants which encourage reflection on the impermanence of life and the permanence of death and so on. I have heard years ago now, and I don't have any evidence myself, I've never followed this up, but someone came to Wat Nanachad once. It's a French scientist, and he told me that they'd been doing some scientific experiments with Pali chants and wiring people up to brain scans. And according to him, at least, the particular cadence, the pitch of the Pali chant is particularly effective in creating alpha waves in the brain and affecting the brain in a positive way. But I don't have any more information on that, but it's a quite fascinating possibility anyway. Okay, I'll leave that one. Next question. In giving dana, is it wrong? Dana meaning tan, hai tan. In giving dana, is it wrong to expect to make merit in the process? Is it true that by giving the same amount to the monk earns you more merits than giving to, let us say, disadvantaged children? First of all, giving dana, making offerings to whoever it might be, there are three factors, mental factors involved to make the merit complete. And that's to say, your intention before you make the offering, the intention at the time of the offering, and the intention or the feeling after the offering. So ideally, that would mean that when one is going to make a gift, donation to a monastery, offering food, offering requisites, or making donation to a charity or whatever, that on that day, then you give yourself some quiet time, and to be some meditation time, or some time just to reflect on what you're doing and the value of it and the significance of it. So that gives you that really good feeling of merit, that feeling of happiness at doing good, the happiness that arises from goodness. And then at the time of making that offering, again, you're caring for your mind. Some people make food, get up early in the morning and make food to take to a monastery, but they get up early and they don't gauge the time very well, and so they're in a hurry and they're constantly looking at the clock and worrying about whether they're going to be on time, and then sit in the car and then quarrel with another family member. And so by the time they get to the monastery, they're completely frazzled, they're tired, fed up, angry, irritated. And so even though the offering is made, all the preliminary work, you know, of caring for the mind and putting that mind in that wholesome, beautiful frame of mind which will make the offering complete, has not been done. Similarly, you can make an offering and then sort of spoil it by allowing your mind to take an unwholesome train. For instance, some people, or it's quite common that people take food to the monastery and then they're constantly looking to see how much the monks take. And then if the monks don't take very much, then being really disappointed or even upset. And there again, that means you're not really caring for your mind. You have to be very clear in your mind that when the offering is made, the merit is made, and how it's used, to what extent it's used, doesn't affect that. And you don't want to allow your mind to be upset by that. So you're caring for your mind before, at the time, and after. So that's the mental side. There are other factors to take involved, and one is the particular gift itself. Is it an appropriate gift? If you're offering something to monks, is it an appropriate gift for a monk? And if it's an inappropriate gift, say you only give a television to a monastery or something like that, I would consider that not a very meritorious gift. Although it might have cost you a lot of money and required quite a considerable financial sacrifice, but lacking wisdom in the gift itself, the merit is not as much as it might be otherwise. And then the recipient of the merit is also important. If in the case of the Sangha, again, if the monks who receive the offering don't keep the monks' discipline properly, or they're misbehaved monks, then that will reduce the amount of merit that's made. So the question asking, should we expect to make merit? Well, yes, I mean, definitely you expect to make merit, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it in the first place. But there's also the important point of really knowing what merit is and maximizing the merit, if you like. Having said that, the Buddha, once gave a discourse on the different levels of merit, and he's saying that even sharing something of yours with an animal is already a huge amount of merit. If you share something with somebody, like a really bad person, human being, you make a lot of merit. The merit increases certainly to the point where if you make an offering to an arahant, a perfectly enlightened being, I would say like that's the maximum merit. But one has to avoid getting into a kind of kind of materialistic frame of mind and thinking, well, I'll give to this one and not that one, because if you could compare it, let's say you get use a kind of materialistic comparison here. Let's say if you give to this person, you get 10 million or say 10 billion units of merit. And if you give to a arahant, you get 1,000 billion units. But in your life, you know, 10 billion is already a huge amount. So it's not something to be sniffed at. In terms, the great example for making merit in the Buddha's time was the layperson called Anathapindika, who you may have heard of. Anathapindika was a very wealthy businessman who offered a monastery in Sarvati, in which the Buddha spent many years. And not needing to work himself anymore, he devoted himself to making merit. So in the morning, he would take food into the monastery and offer to the Sangha. And then after he performed his duties to the Sangha, he would go back home and then feed all the poor people in Sarvati. It's like an equivalent of a soup kitchen. And these, what they call dhammasalas, they still exist today in India, where wealthy people dole out food, rice, chapatis, dal for the poor. And so he was the most prominent of the Buddhist lay followers, and this was the example he gave of making merit by supporting the monastic order with their material needs, and secondly, by doing what one can to alleviate and reduce the suffering in society. So there's never been this kind of question of do you give to monks or do you give to hospitals or do you give to charities. The answer is you give to both. You don't have to make a choice there. It's important to support the monastic order for their needs, but it's also extremely important to support charities and people who lead a disadvantaged life for one reason or another. Says, since you cannot tell us your experiences in monkhood, in teaching us, what would you expect our goal in practicing Dhamma to be? Well, I would expect your goal to be, you know, a measure of your own interest and commitment. I don't think that myself I would feel that I had the right to tell you, you should make this as a goal in your life. The Dhamma is something that invites you inwards. It's a teaching which challenges, but it's a teaching that says, you know, here are the tools, here are the possibilities, take what you feel is appropriate for you. So it's something that has to come from within. It's not something that can be imposed from without. I would say, let's say for a Buddhist lay man or lay woman, generally speaking, then the goal should be what we call stream entry, which is the first level of enlightenment. Now, this first level of enlightenment has been attained by men and women leading ordinary lives in society from the time of the Buddha until the present day. And people who have realized this level of enlightenment have lived within the boundary of the five precepts. They've been family. They've raised families. They've formed duties and responsibilities towards family and society at large. So it's not such an intimidating or far away goal as full enlightenment or arahantship. What that means in everyday life is trying to find a way of living in the world which does not obstruct the realization of spiritual goals, one in which is not making materialistic goals one's prime or single focus, one in which there is a continuing effort to reduce and ultimately eliminate the negative emotions, the obscurations of greed, hatred, and delusion, and seeking to bring into being and to develop the positive qualities of wisdom, compassion, purity, inner freedom, and so on. So it's not merely a matter of, or not at all a matter of being some kind of spiritual athlete and going on meditation courses and trying to gain some kind of special experiences where you see things or you feel things that you've never felt before. It's not a matter of gaining a particular kind of experience, but it's a matter of understanding the nature of all experience. And this is where wisdom and inner freedom really start to take place. This question is, who decides we would be born as a child of a millionaire, a creep, or an unfortunate? Well, I would really question the whole framing of this question, this framework, because there's this assumption that these are three different things, whereas it's quite possible to be a millionaire and an unfortunate creep. You know, they're not necessarily three different things, are they? I think what this, what the questioner probably is trying to ask is, why is it that some people are born wealthy and living comfortably, other people are born in poor families with great struggle in their life. Some people seem to have a very bright, lovable disposition from childhood. Other people can be very difficult and cause a lot of problems for themselves and others. That's perhaps a little bit more tactful way of reframing this question. And I'd like to answer it that, yes, in Buddhism, as you know, we have trust in the law of karma. And law of karma is not something which can be seen purely over one lifetime. And there is a process of rebirth. And note that in English, in Buddhist circles, in English, we tend to avoid the word reincarnation. Consider that to be either a Hindu or a kind of New Age word. And we prefer rebirth. And there was just a point, there was a conference a few years ago of Buddhist teachers in Dharamsala in India, which was chaired by Dalai Lama. And the question came up about birth control. And one of my friends was attending this conference, Ajahn Amaro. And the Dalai Lama asked Ajahn Amaro whether Theravada Buddhists believed in birth control. And he says, we believe in rebirth control. So we try to live our lives in such a way that if we're not enlightened, at least can be sure of a fortunate rebirth. Yes, obviously it's preferable to be born into a family in which the four requisites are secure, to say where there is adequate food, clothing, shelter, medicines when one's sick. And the causal conditions for that are the way that one's lived one's life. I mean, I don't think it's an accident that, or merely chance, that there's never been any great famine in Thailand. You know, the tradition of dana and giving and sharing food is so strong, has been so strong throughout the centuries here, that this is a karmic force which prevents something like famine happening here. There's nobody who decides. It's a matter of causal processes. And if you are generous and not selfish, then you're creating very wholesome karmic causes. If you are born into a wealthy family, but you're extremely selfish and possessive of your wealth, or even seek to increase your wealth by cheating others, then your experience of wealth is going to be short-lived, even if you are able to carry on living comfortably in this lifetime. It's very unlikely that you will in a future lifetime. So the teaching of rebirth is something really to be taken on and considered, because considering it may well lead you to make different choices in how you live your life. I would like, speaking about on this topic, I often give a simile, and that simile is of having a map. You are traveling in a strange, unusual country. Some kind friend has given you an extremely detailed map. Now you start to walk through this countryside, and you look very closely at your map, and you look to the left and you look to the right, and every single detail in the landscape is accurately represented in the map. So after some time, you develop a strong confidence in this map. This is a really good map. This is a really accurate map. Now suppose you take a rest and you open up the map and you look far ahead and you see representations of a mountain range. And it says these mountains are 20,000 feet high, 25,000 feet high. Now you have come from an extremely flat country where there's no mountain higher than about 100 feet. You've never seen one, you've never seen pictures of one. All you've ever seen is flatness. Now, if you look at this map and you see the map says that if you keep on walking in this direction, you're going to come to mountains 20,000 feet high. It would be completely reasonable and rational to say, rubbish. I can't even imagine how that can possibly be. Everything in my experience, my common sense, everything tells me it's not possible. The highest piece of land I've ever seen is 100 foot, and you're telling me there's something 20,000 feet high. But then another voice kicks in and it says, but hold on, this map in the corner which I have personally verified by walking through the area it maps or relates to, this map is extremely accurate. Now, is it possible, or is it likely, that a map is extremely accurate in one corner and completely inaccurate in another corner? So here you say, well, yes, that's a point too, isn't it? It seems more likely that a map is either completely inaccurate or completely accurate, or if it is inaccurate, only in very small details, not in huge features like this. Now, the analogy I'm drawing here is with the Buddha's teaching. There are a number of teachings which you can verify in your daily life, in your own experience, without too much difficulty. When you look at the Buddha's teachings, you read the Buddha's teachings, and you just have this real sense of acceptance. Yes, this is accurate. This is true. This accurately represents what my experience of life as a human being is all about. So when you come to teachings about other realms, heaven realms, hell realms, past lives, future lives, which you don't have the capacity, at least as yet, to personally verify. One part of you says it's ridiculous, it's just so utterly unlike anything I've ever experienced. It doesn't seem that it could be true. It's just some kind of story. But then the other voice kicks in and says, well, everything that the Buddha has taught me from his own experience so far has been correct. Is it likely that this whole area of the teachings is completely inaccurate? And I think it's reasonable to say, well, it's unlikely. So you take that humble position that, yes, you don't know. That's where you start off with. You know what you know, and you know what you don't know. You don't have to pretend to know things you don't know. If you can take on the teaching of rebirth, but you take it on humbly accepting, yes, I don't really know. But I choose to believe it because, and you have reasons for that belief. And this is how you care for the truth. You don't say that something must be true because you believe it. You know, this is often a case with people with very strong religious beliefs, isn't it? They say, this is true. And you say, it says here in this book. And you say, well, how do you know it's true? Because it's in a book. Well, it's because I just feel it. I just feel it in my heart so strongly. You know, it must be true. Okay. But then you've got what we call circular reasoning, haven't you? Something is true because I believe it, and I believe it because it's true. But this is a false argument, isn't it? That something doesn't become true just because of the strength of the feeling that it produces within your mind. And it's possible, and I'm sure we've all had mistaken beliefs in the past, which we've all believed in very strongly. So in Buddhism we say, be very careful when you refer to the truth, and always make a clear distinction between what you believe but as yet have not verified, and what you have verified as a direct experience. And this is the way to, I would say, harmony between people of different cultures and different religions. It's because people have such a strong attachment to their beliefs and invest in them so much and find it utterly unacceptable that someone should have different beliefs, that there's so much conflict in the world. But as Buddhists, we don't buy into all that, do we? I mean, we have this, you have the Christian fundamentalist extremists, you have the Hindu fundamentalist extremist, Muslim fundamentalist extremists, but have you noticed that there's no such thing as a Buddhist fundamentalist extremist? You know, why is that? Is that just, you know, is that just by chance? Or is it something that is a result of some deep part of a Buddha's teaching and the wisdom of the Buddha Dhamma? And that would certainly be my view.